Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and welcome to the program. Joining me this week are my excellent panel from the City of Angels, attorney, actually well-known, respected attorney, Peter Haven. Peter, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much, Simon, and you're too kind for that introduction. It's more than I deserve.
you never know when you might need a friendly attorney.
Well, here I am.
And from the very center of the universe, Youngstown, Ohio, author, activist, barkeep, and roustabout, Sam Murphy. Sam, welcome to the program.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, but I'd like to just put a little editing on it. It's not the center of the universe. It is the land that time forgot.
Oh, okay. Silly me. I will make sure that I pass that along to my copywriters.
Please.
And from New Jersey, the land that time hasn't forgot, because it's been immortalized in movies, Bill Conrad. Bill, how are you doing today?
I am fine. It did get cold here, though. It was warmer Friday night than it was in the daytime, and today's high is predicted for around 32. So I
19 years, it's coming your way, Bill.
Cool. Keep it.
We got a roaring fire going in the background, if you can hear it.
Yeah. God's been playing with that thermostat again.
To be honest with you, it has cooled off in Mississippi. In fact, I put on a long sleeve shirt today. I mean, that's how bad it has got.
I guess we got to send you a box of goodies to keep you warm.
Yeah, I'm seriously contemplating searching out a jacket. I mean,
you need a space heater.
Yeah, and put it outside and
air it out for a day or two.
Right, and you know, we could heat the whole town up. Okay, it has been a very busy week, and honestly, I don't know where we should start. We have George Zimmerman, who has now had his fourth close encounter with the law. Iran is offering what many consider an off-color white flag of surrender. Yesterday was the anniversary of the fabulous BBC sci-fi series Doctor Who, and I must confess that I am so stinking old. I watched the first episode on the day it was aired. We have Afghanistan asking for our military help, and the Dems want to kill the filibuster. And Sam, I'm going to pick on you. Pick a subject. or one off the list? You're
well,
in charge.
I'm not being a fan of Doctor Who. I hope someone else does that. And I'm not because I'm not a fan. I just never watched it. So I hope others will talk about that. I've heard nice things about it, good things about it. Obviously, we've done the air for 50 years. There's got to be something to it. So other people can talk about that. I think I'm going to start with a simple one, but a good one that we all can chime in on, and that would be the quote-unquote nuclear option done by the Democrats this year. I think, you know, this last week in order to get, I guess for lack of a better term, pack the D.C. District Court and, you know, get it their way. I think it's an issue that surprisingly hasn't been done. You're considering that it's been in place since, I think, 75, 76, something like that, when the Senate changed the rules. It's been around for, let's see, we're talking, what, Carter, Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, and Bush 2, and Obama's first term. And through all those 30, 40 years, both houses, the Senate, been in the Republican hands, it's been in the Democrats' hands. They've talked about it. I saw tons of clips over the last week where Joe Biden, Obama himself, and other Democrats screamed that the Republicans, when they controlled the Senate, better not do the quote-unquote nuclear option, and the Republicans didn't. They threatened, but they never did. And finally, the Democrats did. And it was ordered to get their picks in. And I think the situation here is, I think, there should be the filibuster should be what the filibuster is. You want a filibuster, it shouldn't be 60 votes, it shouldn't be majority, it should be like it was in the way the Constitution was written, and like if everybody's ever seen Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, that great scene with Jeff with Jimmy Stewart playing Jefferson Smith Talks Forever. We've seen a couple filibusters this last year where people actually had where people had to stand, take the floor, and talk in order to bring stop legislation, delay legislation, or shine a light on it. I think Luann Paul was fabulously successful in his, and I think Ted Cruz is fabulously unsuccessful in his. But that said, it's going to really be a cold winter in Washington because it's what already is a very partisan group of men and women in the Senate and House. Just got even more partisan with this vote. It's going to really be a pain in the ass when it comes time to this budget that they got to do that they didn't do last time. They're going to have to do again. And it's going to make a bad situation worse. And the Democrats really roll the dice, because in the 2014 elections, midterms come around, and the Republicans take the House. I don't think they're going to take the nuclear option off the Senate, and you'll see the Republicans in the majority rubbing the face of the Democrats' minority into it. So it should be interesting to see what happens.
Okay. Do you want to explain exactly what the nuclear option is?
Sure. Thank you. Oh, by the way, before I did, I wrote what I'm talking about right now. I wrote in my first column for this great website called Blogger News Network, which our famous host Simon Barrett is now the king, president, CEO, CFO, owner, and basically he's the Ted Turner of Blogger News, and I want to applaud him for what he had to do to take control of this. The site will be much better than it was, not that it was bad before. Simon will take it to new and great length, and I thank you for giving me the opportunity to jot some thoughts down once a week on it, Simon. Congratulations to you.
Well, thank you very much, but I don't own it. My wife, Jan, owns it. I have to do what she tells me to do.
Okay, as all of us married men do. anyway, but basically what happened, for those of you who aren't familiar with this, and I've been using it myself, the phrase nuclear option is just a terrible phrase to be throwing around, given what's going on in Iran and what nuclear really means. But that aside, the Senate is always the United States Senate always considered itself the most deliberating body in the history of democracies and getting things done. And which one of the things was they had unlimited debate and all sorts of unlimited debate being a filibuster. Someone could stand up and, like I said, and talk forever if they could without leaving the floor or yielding to the floor, basically to either delay legislation from being passed so his colleagues could run around and get the votes, or to shine a light on it, like Rand Paul did with about the NSA and the spying and the drone. But what happened was in the mid-70s, in order to stop doing that, to really literally get out there and do that quote-unquote filibuster and stand on your feet, the Senate passed a rule where if they had 60 votes, if you couldn't get 60 votes, two-thirds majority, I think, whatever, Republicans or Democrats could put holds on nominees, they could delay legislation or whatnot, because they would threaten filibuster. They didn't have to go out and do it, they would threaten it. And if the head of the Senate, in this case it's Harry Reid, couldn't muster 60 votes, that person may never get nominated. The president might not get some special legislation through, might not get appointees appointed, because the Senate's great job is to advise and consent, and with judicial appointments, numa uno. And to make a longer story longer, basically the Republicans have been doing exactly what the Democrats did under Bush. Lots of filibustering, threatening the filibuster, holding up nominations. It's gotten worse under Bush than it was before under Clinton and the other Bush and Reagan. It got even worse under Obama. That's how partisan Washington is. I don't think I'm saying anything new. Well, anyway, to get all these Obama people appointed, Harry Reid dropped the nuclear option with just a simple majority. So instead of 60 votes, they only have to have 51. The Democrats have 52 with two independents, and so they got 51 votes. A couple Democrats who are up for re-election next year sided with the Republicans. It was a 51-49 vote, and now you just need a simple majority to get people done. So Obama will really pack the highly influential Washington, D.C. District Court of Appeals with a lot of his people. And that's what the Republicans were against, because it's a highly influential court. Helps up with the Supreme Court, and Peter probably could tell the people more about how influential that court is than I can. And that's basically it. So what had been working, I guess you could say, in a way, it was partisan, it was bipartisanship. Both parties agreed to the 60 vote, and both used it for their political purposes. Democrats have used it in the minority. Republicans have used it in the minority. Now, that doesn't exist anymore. And in a way, you could say the majority really kicked the minority in the ass. They said, that's the way it's, this is the way we want it. These are the people we want on. We're in the majority. Tough shit. And they played the tough shit card. And now they better hope that the Republicans don't take control of the Senate, because it'll be tough shit back the other way.
Right. And Peter, I have to ask you, you know... a great deal about, Washington. How do you feel about this change? Frankly, I looked at it and went, well, we vote these senators in, and as long as the majority go for something, why shouldn't it be copacetic?
Well, I'm not sure that it shouldn't be. I mean, that's what that's one of the underpinnings of Congress. And as far as I understood this rule, it was an existing rule. It wasn't some sort of constitutional mandate. So apparently, Congress had some rule in effect. And apparently, by vote of Congress, that rule could be changed. And the only change, as I understand it, was that for approval of presidential nominees, with the exception of Supreme Court justices, a simple the change is that a simple majority will constitute sufficient approval. It doesn't have to be 60. It can just be any a majority, 50% plus one. And I'm just I'm not sure how and why that rule impacts filibustering, but it seems to impact filibustering. But I I'm not sure what the problem is. That's just a simple rule voted on by the House of Representatives, or the Senate, and that's the rule now. So I personally don't have a real problem with it one way or another. It just seems like politics in action, and if anything, it's going to expedite getting things done in Capitol Hill, which to me seems like a good thing.
Right. I'm not sure if I have the number right. Listeners, please don't beat me up on technicalities, but there's something like 260 nominations that are essentially on hold at the moment, because of the 60-40 rule, and certainly at least one Republican, who shall remain nameless, is, threatening filibusters on all of them. So effectively, nothing will get done. I'm with you on this, Peter. I don't see a problem with the simple majority vote. I've no doubt Sam takes different views.
No. I don't have a problem with it. I actually think that it's. I was just trying to explain it, and if I got lost in kind of editorializing it, then I apologize. And I have to the victors go to spoils. I just said it's just going to create, what I got to see, it's going to create more partisanship that we don't already need, because it was a bipartisan rule that had been in effect for, 40 years, for some 40-odd years. That's now gone, so now you're going to have people more pissed off than they are, if that's possible in Washington. I believe in the Constitution. It allowed them to filibuster. For years, they've been getting away without filibustering by putting this rule in. So they didn't have to stand on the floor like we've seen Rand Paul do. Strom Thurmond did it in the 40s for a while for a terrible reason, but he did it. I think he holds the record. It was a very effective tool to block legislation or to change legislation in the old days. So they would get some senator on the floor to buy time where they could politic on the side and make their deals and bring compromise, because good government is good compromise. So I don't have if these guys get elected to pay to, filibuster, then filibuster. Then if a Republican wants to filibuster, or a Democrat in the future, if the Republicans ever take control of the Senate, they're going to have to stand on the floor and they're going to have to try to do it the old-fashioned way. So I don't have a problem with it. It is majority rules, and that's the way it is. And, hopefully Obama's appointments will be decent, honorable folks.
And we haven't heard anything from Bill. No, I'm sure he's falling asleep on the end of the telephone. Bill, give us your thoughts.
Just like Peter said, anything that's going to make it so we can get some decisions made quicker is a better way of balancing out the majority, as a back down to 51 is such a good thing. Again, if you're going to filibuster, it's silly by not having somebody out there just yakking away. I would like to hear some of their yakking aways, because, frankly, the things they talk about so far haven't made a whole lot of sense. And maybe some of the filibusters, we might actually become smarter, greater people in the United States.
Well, we could certainly learn more about Dr. Zeus.
You know, I just think, you know, what's so bad if they start, if they really have to filibuster and do their jobs? I mean, you think about it, when they passed this law, it was a way for them to skirt the law so they didn't have to stand up on the and talk on the Senate floor. Or, you know, they'd all read from Dr. Seuss or whatever they did, or, you know, it's a good thing. I understand it happened, and Peter, you bring up a great point that was done. They said if one of the Supreme Court justices goes, something happens, retires, whatever, leaves, then the 51 vote isn't in effect, and then someone could, you know, then they could filibuster it. But you know, you never see that happen. I haven't seen that happen in a long time. When they've done a Supreme Court nominee, they love to parade them out and then annihilate them in the hearings if they don't like them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. The hearings are just so they're just so horrible. What they bring out that may not be true or not, but because it raises suspicion on them, it's undocumented. It's a bad thing, you know.
All right, but I want to bring up something that Peter mentioned earlier. How does filibuster and change to a simple majority have anything to do with each other? Sam, you got any thoughts?
I'll let Peter talk. You asked him the question.
Well, I asked the question, and I'm not clear on the relationship between this rule change and filibustering. I think there is a clear relationship, but I don't understand what the relationship is. The so-called nuclear option, as I have as I understand it, is something that says it was a change of a long-standing Senate rule, and it said that with respect to presidential nominees, all except Supreme Court justices, used to be you needed 60 votes in the 100-member Senate to get approval, and now all you need is 51. And I'm not clear on how that rule changes filibustering, but I don't dispute that it does. I just don't understand the relationship.
Well, you know what I think it is? I think if the 60 is in a filibuster, it's a hold. It's a hold, really. Because it's a hold on the nomination.
I suppose that filibustering can only occur for as long as it takes to get the requisite number of people to vote on a matter, to pass a matter. And if you're going to try to filibuster while a nominee is pending and 51 people are ready to approve the nominee, then I suppose that's how it works. That's how it negates
that's
the filibuster.
What I think it does,
because,
too. Yeah, I think,
because the filibuster doesn't do any good. You can only filibuster for so long, I believe, until the Senate is ready to act on something. And if it's ready to act, then all the filibuster.
Well,
the world
if
I'm won't.
Filibustering, if I understand it, and you may be right. Simon nominates you to be on a judge, okay? That you're to be president. I put a hold on you, and then if I can't muster if I can't muster the votes, that used to be 60, then your nomination goes through and we vote on it. But if I couldn't get 60, your nomination just stays there until we can lobby and get things done and horse trade and all that stuff. But if I wanted to filibuster you and there was going to be a vote, then I would take the Senate floor and hold the floor as long as I could without relinquishing it. Follow what I'm saying?
Right.
Two different things. The nuclear option really was these people were just our senators, Republicans and Democrats. If the president was whoever he was, said, I nominate Peter Haven to be an appointment, and some senator didn't like you or wanted something from the president, they would put a hold on you. And if the Senate leader couldn't get 60 votes to break that hold, your nomination would just stay there forever. It just was frozen. But if the Senate leader could get 60 votes, there was no way they could have a filibuster, and they'd go from there. And it really isn't a filibuster. I don't know why that phrase came out, because it's really not a filibuster. It's a threat in a filibuster on the Senate rule. It's really a hold. The Senate, some senators were putting holds on presidential nominees for many positions, but for only one reason. They wanted something out of the president. You know, that's all you can think about. Why would they put holds on these nominees? Because it stops the business of government moving along. It stops the business of whatnot. I could never understand that, because they never had hearings. They never had a vote. It was just some senator grabs the nominee by the shoulder and says, "You're not moving forward," and the Senate majority leader can't get the votes together, and it just stays in a quagmire.
Hey, Peter, is this kind of like almost like a court injunction for a will or something like that? It's just that's the way it works in the Senate.
No, it's a purely procedural matter. You know. These are basically loosely called parliamentary rules of procedure, and they apply usually in any circumstance where you have lawmakers gathered, and they have to have procedures in place for doing things. And it's typical, the typical kind of stuff that is associated with this. I move that we pass the piece of legislation, and the chairman says, "We've had a motion to pass the legislation. Does anyone second the motion?" "I second the motion." "Okay, the motion to approve the legislation to seek approval of the legislation has been passed. Now we will submit the matter to a vote," blah, 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 blah. And this is just the way you try to maintain order in a proceeding like this. And one of the procedures that's available is you have the opportunity to debate or discuss the subject matter. The gentleman from Missouri requests permission to address the body regarding this motion to approve legislation. Good afternoon, honorable colleagues, esteemed gentlemen and gentle ladies and gentle persons. I hereby wish to address this noble, great body on one of a matter that I think is very important. Blah, 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 hot air, hot air, hot air. And a filibuster is when one of these people has the floor, they've been given the floor, and then they just proceed to talk and talk and talk and talk and talk, and they do not relinquish the floor, and in that manner, they can tie up the whole body, because, they've been given the floor, they have the right to get their word out, and that's what a filibuster is. Now, if I'm to understand the interplay between a filibuster and this rule change, I think that this rule for the majority vote with respect to approval of presidential nominees, I think this rule existed within the general overview of rules that were said to be filibustering rules. And so I think that's the interplay with a filibuster. I don't know much more than that, because I always find a filibuster to be ridiculous, but, it's a tried and accepted practice in our body politic, and everybody loves it because it's so great for movies and stuff.
That's only worked once in a movie.
Well, it once apparently was enough. Now every legislature on earth can't wait to have his day in the sun and filibuster. They think it's the height of glory.
Well, who's the only one who's done one is Simon's favorite Senate and future presidential candidate, who will get 3% of the vote in Iowa, Ted Cruz. And my guy, Rand Paul, who did it, and I think he did a lot. I think he didn't read from Dr. Seuss. But I don't think anybody else.
Well,
I agree, every one of these guys at one point, Barack Obama had filibustered, but without filibustering when he was a senator. So did Joe Biden. And you're right, they used this rule to muck up a lot of presidential nominees. Maybe some were good. Maybe Obama, when he was a senator, had a legitimate reason to hold up some of Bush's nominees, and vice versa. Maybe some of these are legitimate holds on people that we don't know about because they never go in front of the American people.
The rules exist for a reason, and they're there, and people utilize them, and it's obviously an accepted practice. I'm just not a big fan of it because, you know, I can't stand procrastination. I just want to get things done and move on. But, you know, that's just yet another reason why I would never be able to be a politician. It would drive me insane. But, you know, it is what it is. It's part of our process.
Okay, a question that I have to ask you all. Have any of you ever read a book, The Pelican Brief?
Saw the movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, not too many people read anymore. You know, the book's been going through my mind for quite some time now. It's a simple concept. You know, own the Supreme Court, and you own the U.S. And, you know, if you can stack the court, you can have your way long after, you know, a president of whatever color, you know, owns the deal, shall we say.
So the theory goes.
Right. You know, now, as far as I can see, the Supremes are pretty much half and half, you know, party-wise. And, yeah, I think they do a reasonably good job. I'm not a lawyer. Peter, you are. Do you like the Supremes?
Well, I think the Supreme Court obviously serves a very important function. I don't like to see the Supreme Court politicized, and the Constitution is set up so that it has a minimal, it is minimally influenced on the political process. And this goes to one of the things you just talked about, that there have always been presidents or administrations or parties that believe they can stack the court. But the Constitution anticipated that type of influence, and what it did was it basically created something called Article III powers. Article III, the first article addresses the powers of the administrative branch, which is the president. Second article addressed the powers of the legislative branch, and the third article addressed the powers of the judicial branch. And one of the things they did for all federal judges, including the Supreme Court, is they made them lifetime appointees. And the theory is that absent, something that qualifies as an impeachment offense, you're on there for life. So once you're appointed, the theory is you're free from whatever political influence got you there. And historically, this has tended, or at least there are examples where it's worked, because we've had different administrations try to pack the court, and after they tried to pack the court, the justices who supposedly were going to do follow party lines strictly, they sometimes abandoned what would be traditional party lines, and they voted with whatever they believed. It's an imperfect process, but generally speaking, I like the Supreme Court, but more importantly, it's an absolute necessity because the Supreme Court exists as the ultimate interpreter of what the words of the Constitution mean. So unless you have this highest court of last resort to answer an issue of what the meaning of the Constitution is in certain contexts, you don't have the Constitution. You have 50 states that are free to interpret it any way they want, and you need one unified court to lay down a standard about what it is or is not permitted or required by the Constitution.
And Sam, back to you. Do you have any additions to what Peter said?
No, I think that the great thing about the body politic of America that the founding fathers have and still works today is that we have checks and balances, and the Supreme Court is a very important part of that. Just like the Senate is a very big important part of the advising consent to the president and have to vote on these nominations. Just like the House controls the purse strings, and the president, the executive, and there's the foreign policy. I mean, with everybody voting on stuff, when it works great. Unfortunately, it hasn't worked for a while. because I think the one thing the founding fathers did not plan on was, and I can't blame them, is the influence of money, the influence of special interest, and all that. They knew, if you read Alexander Hamilton,
Alexis
knew that was going to happen in the Federalist, okay? And, if you read him, what he wrote, I mean, he predicted that was going to happen. But they had the right to do that because it was a democracy. They had a right to lobby for their rights. I just didn't think that no one ever realized how far it would go and how I can't believe that Thomas Jefferson said, geez, okay, I got defeated as president. I want to come back and become a lobbyist on K Street. I don't think any of them ever thought it was going to turn into what it turned into, that people, ex-politicians, would leave office, get defeated, whatnot, maybe even leave in disgrace, and then come back as a lobbyist, a high-priced lobbyist, because they know how the system works. I mean, you talk about an insider's game. Woo! But that's what's happened. And don't forget, when our founding fathers wrote the Constitution and did this great thing, a wonderful street didn't it existed, but it wasn't a really financial juggernaut that it is now. There was no such thing as Wall Street. anyway, yes, it works when it's working great, but unfortunately, I think as someone has said, some comedian once said, I think other people have picked up on it, all our politicians should be like NASCAR drivers, and they should wear suits that have their corporate sponsors on them. And I think American people would understand why their interests are never looked after.
I rather like that. I hadn't heard that comment before. Bill, do you think all of the lawmakers should have to wear suits with logos on?
I think that's a wonderful way to go. I think it helps us to not be misled. I think we will understand who the players are. I think one of the other misgivings or misunderstandings by our founding fathers was to realize that modern medicine would come as far as it has. Modern medicine tends to help the people who are politically corrupt to be able to live the longest because they have the money to get the health care. And I think that that was a big oversight where people's average length of life was about 28 to 30 years. So now they've learned the system and they come back as these the lobbyist consultants. So didn't figure on that either.
They're like cats. They have 1,000 lives.
There you go.
hey, hot off the press, hot off the press. Simon's going to be in a good mood. Peter's not. Simon, your Chargers won. Peter, your Dolphins lost.
Yes, I watched the demise of Miami, and all I can say is the only reason they lost is because the other team was better.
Well, they played a very good team. That Cam Newton's a hell of a ball player.
Oh, it's ridiculous. It's frustrating. Simon, I didn't realize you were a Charger fan. How did that happen?
Well, I lived in San Diego for 10 years.
Well, that'll do it. Well, congratulations. They won. Miami lost. And, again, it's only because Miami sucked that it lost.
Well, and isn't that the same sort of thing that Don Meredith used to always reply back to Howard Cosell, "Howard, you have such a keen sense for the obvious."
Yeah, you have a profound mastery of the obvious. That's what I tell
there
people.
There it is. There you go.
Meredith said it better. But alas, I filibuster. Forgive me.
Okay. Let's move on. I have lots of other delicious items to talk about. How about George Zimmerman, the guy acquitted of killing teen, what was his name?
Trayvon Martin.
Trayvon Martin. All right. He's had his fourth close encounter with the law. I haven't checked his status today, but I do believe that once again he is out of jail, GPS'd, you know, ankle bracelet. This time he beat up his girlfriend, threw her out of the house, blocked the doors with furniture, threatened her with a gun, etc., etc. I'm going to start with Peter. Peter, isn't this shades of what we saw with OJ? You get away with one thing, but you just start to think that you're bigger than life, you're larger than life, and bad things happen, you end up back in jail.
I think it is. You know, I used to tell people back in the days when we were hunting OJ, I used to say, you know, the Lord works in mysterious ways, and so does the legal system also. The wheels of justice keep turning. It's not always clear where they're going to go, but I think that eventually they get to the right place. And or you could just call it karma. This is the kind of guy who, you know, unfortunately seems to have a predilection for getting himself into trouble. And it's interesting. I was just reading the other day. Some of you may remember, you know, with this latest incident involving the Florida State football player who's accused of rape. Some of you may remember a few years ago there was a big scandal in Duke because two or three lacrosse players were accused of gang raping basically a woman who was a stripper who came over there for some party. And I just read the other day that woman who accused them of rape has now been convicted of murdering her boyfriend. She's going to get, you know, some incredibly long period of time in prison now. You know, I do believe that people who are sort of destined for trouble end up in trouble. And with respect to Zimmerman, you know, this most recent allegation, if I'm not mistaken, he, you know, he got into a fight with his, I guess she's now filed for divorce, so I'll call her his ex-wife. He got into a confrontation.
No.
No?
You are wrong.
Please correct me.
This doesn't involve his
ex-wife. Is it his
girlfriend? Yep, his brand new girlfriend.
All right. Well, whoever it is, if I'm not mistaken, one of the problems was that he waved a gun in her face. And maybe that was the ex-wife, maybe it was the girlfriend, but that was one of the things that supposedly he was accused of. And, you know, that just takes me back to my whole song and dance about guns. There are some people, in my opinion, who just shouldn't have them. And I, for one, believe that whatever happened that night with Trayvon Martin, given the kind of personality we're dealing with here with Zimmerman, I believe that the gun was the most serious culprit that night, because the gun is what gave Zimmerman the bravado, which I don't think he would have had otherwise, to confront this person. And, you know, again, he's gotten into some other problem. I don't know if it's his wife or his girlfriend. But in one of these accounts that I read, he was waving a gun or allegedly accused of threatening her with a gun. You know, it's just it's another bad mix. But your big point, Simon, is correct. I think this is just a guy who I think it's going to be very difficult for him to stay on the right side of things. He just seems to have a predilection for going down the wrong path, and it's just a matter of time before he catches up with him if he doesn't, you know, clean up his act.
Oh, there is no doubt about that. But personally,
I'm reading an account right now, and it says Zimmerman, who is currently waiting a trial for a brutal attack on his pregnant girlfriend, an attack which included him brandishing an AK-47 in her face, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, this is a guy, in my opinion, who, quite frankly, just shouldn't have access to firearms. I mean, he just shouldn't. There's no way to prevent it in our world. It's a sad commentary, but I just don't think he has the right to own a gun. I just don't think he does.
I'm with you. Sam, do you have any thoughts on the honorable, esteemed George Zimmerman?
Yeah, and Peter, I got to really compliment you, because when this episode 2 happened with his ex-wife-to-be and episode 3 would have been his new pregnant girlfriend-to-be, the first thing that popped into my mind was something you said when we were talking about this during the trial, a little before, during the trial, and after, is when you brought up the stuff about OJ, and you just said you knew it was one of those things that he was never going to be free. Even though he was freed,
right?
He was never going to be free again, because he was just...
You're never going to be free of something
right,
like this,
and
right?
And you said something, and it was just, that was the first thing that popped into my mind. I was like, wow, Peter Haven really nailed this one. And you did, and I got to congratulate you for that and compliment you. And and it's amazing, you know. And then you see, and then I don't understand how he's had the gun after Trayvon Martin. But as we all know, that it's so easy to get a gun anywhere that he had one. But you know, he's just a matter of time before he kills somebody again. Obviously, he's got some huge issues, and you know, I don't know. You think about, we all know what he went through. We all know about everything that's happened. I mean, where can this guy go?
You would think that somebody who survives the gauntlet that he survived, you would think that he would come out of it and he would feel like, oh my goodness, I've been given a new lease on life. I've survived, and I've been given a new lease on life, and I'm going to make the most of it, and I'm going to stay out of trouble. And that was the exact same thing that I thought about O.J. Simpson. I mean, he faced criminal prosecution, 2 counts, felony murder, and that carried with it the death penalty. He faced literally a life-or-death situation, and quite frankly, you would have expected someone like that to, you would have expected a human being, I should say, to emerge from that process and just get on his knees and thank God that he escaped. And you would expect them, in my opinion, if they're a normal human being, to just basically try really hard to live a good life after that. And, you know, in the case of Zimmerman, you would certainly expect him to at least, you know, be good for a couple of years. You know, it's like, it's just normal human nature. When you get a speeding ticket, you know, don't you drive really slow after that? I mean, don't you really pay attention to the road? I mean, isn't that just human nature? You would think that these guys would just, they would be so grateful for what they had dodged that they would, you know, they'd basically live a good life. But for whatever influence they have going on, it just can't keep them out of harm's way. It just can't.
I'm going to go to Bill. Bill, maybe Peter and I know way more about OJ than we should. but you know, do you have any thoughts on OJ or Zimmerman?
Well, one of the things I read today was from the NBC News website. And it was a discussion with the Florida authorities. Let's see, Seminole County Sheriff Officer Chief Deputy Dennis Lemma, and he cites a part of a conversation with Zimmerman, saying that that Zimmerman's girlfriend has a 9mm, and she had it there, and that they were discussing about their guns with each other. And she told Zimmerman that she was pregnant, and so he started packing to leave because she kept insisting that, you know what, I need to raise this child on my own, and you need to get out of the house and get out of here. So he starts packing, and then he says she snaps, and she let him continue to pack his stuff, and then she got mad at him and started throwing things at him. She broke a glass table, and then after the whole interview, prosecution's office or the sheriff said the victim disclosed that she's not even pregnant. So, you know, we're talking about some communication problems all around here, in which Zimmerman and his girlfriend just don't seem to know how to play nice in the sandbox. And he has such a bad, you dodge a speeding ticket or something, and you drive really nice after that. I would have thought that Zimmerman would have moved to Canada or to Europe or just got the heck out of here and just try to start it all over. But he's like, he's like a wingnut magnet, or else he is such a, I mean, who would want to date this person? You know, I would be afraid to have, to start, dating some woman who's got a reputation for toting her gun out in her boyfriend's. And
It's interesting when you say who would want to date that person. I thought you were talking about who would want to date Zimmerman.
But who would?
Well, I think unfortunately we live in a world, and it's unfortunate, but we live in a world where people are drawn to celebrity status for all the wrong reasons. And I do think that being someone who's in the news and whose face is everywhere, I do think that can cause people to get distorted views of themselves and the world they live in. And it seems to me there's a little bit of that going on with Zimmerman. And it seems to me that whatever this girlfriend or whatever saw in him, it seems to me that had some role to play in it. And so to a certain extent, these people all seem to deserve each other, so to speak. But, I don't know how to describe it. I just can't help but come away with thinking the same thing over and over again, that anybody in his position who dodged this kind of bullet, no pun intended, would stay out of trouble for as long as he possibly could. But it just doesn't seem like that's in the cards for him.
At least a year, right? At least a year.
Well,
go
you know,
a year.
You think at least a year. Go a year. Just say, it's just like one day at a time. I'm just going to try to make it through today without getting in any trouble. But, you know, when you're sitting around with assuming what you said was true, that I guess you start with how did he end up in this mess? Assuming what you said was true about the account that was reported between them, why isn't he still with his current wife? I mean, she supported him throughout this ridiculous mess, but I guess they got in a fight and they had problems. And I don't know whether he's drinking or anything like that would contribute to this volatile behavior. But, you know, you'd think that if they survived that together as a couple, they would have still been together, but apparently not. And he's immediately with some other girlfriend, and she's talking to him about being pregnant. So obviously he didn't waste any time getting into bed with someone else. And here he is in trouble again. They're sitting there brandishing their guns, talking about how cool they are, and one thing leads to another. I mean, who would have figured? It's just the whole thing just makes me shake my head. There's nothing else you can really say or do about it.
Sam, I've been married for longer than you have. Do you and your wife go to bed and talk about guns?
Oh, my first wife, she would bring a gun into the bed. sometimes she'd bring a gun, and sometimes she'd bring a gun when I was in bed, and she would be sitting in the door. No, I don't know. There's something wrong with this guy, obviously. Peter, I agree with you about Bill, too. You know, you would think this guy or his lawyers, obviously, or somebody, once he got this thing, said, okay, Mr. Zimmerman, for the next year, you're going to be a volunteer at the rescue mission in your town, and you're going to help the less fortunate, the poor, and all this. And you're going to be a model citizen. You're going to stay away from trouble, and you're going to do all this stuff. You're going to go go back to school, do something, go lecture, you know, do whatever you have to do. You know, that's what I thought his profile would be. To, as you said, Peter, you brought up something about celebrity. He didn't do anything to cash in on his celebrity items, and maybe it's because he's such a walking time bomb. You know, I can't believe that no one would have paid him to give lectures on.
You talk about cashing in on celebrity status, and of course that's one way to milk a celebrity thing. But what I was trying to express is the addictive quality of celebrity status in and of itself.
Okay.
You know, people who, you know, I believe everyone is susceptible to it, but when you suddenly become famous for whatever reason, I think it has a way of altering the way you look at the world, and it becomes a kind of addiction. You know, you can't stand the thought of just being normal. You can't stand the thought of just being a face in the crowd. You can't stand the thought of nobody knowing who you are or, quote-unquote, how important you are. And I think that that's one thing that that can really mess with someone's mind. And I think – pardon me?
I was going to say, do you guys think that – I was thinking just the thing about how he got guns, but I'm wondering, because of the death threats, was he allowed to keep a gun?
Well, I don't think there's any prohibition against him having a firearm, certainly not in Florida or wherever he lives.
There is right now.
There is now, but prior to this incident, I mean, he hadn't been convicted of a crime.
Wouldn't you have thought that would have been a stipulation in his
when he was found innocent, there was some, help me, there was some, you know, strings attached to him being able to have a gun. For some reason, I thought I read that somewhere.
I don't know, but typically when you're acquitted, you know, there's no negotiation. You've gone to trial and you've won. And so I don't know what grounds there would be. Now, there may have been some other lesser charge defense that he settled for, and he copped a plea that included not having firearms or whatever. But I haven't heard any mention of that, so I don't think that was any kind of condition.
But I understand what you're saying, and I understand about, you know, the catching, you know. But I guess in his case, he was more infamous than famous, and he really couldn't stick his. He was probably just sat in his house all day getting depressed.
Maybe so, but you know what the whole thing reminded me of, and I, you know, sometimes I'm a very poor prognosticator, but sometimes I'm spot on. And I remember many years ago, you know, when Lance Armstrong was winning all his races, and I remember hearing the story about him as being a guy who was basically in a hospital bed suffering from cancer that had riddled his entire body, and his wife was his nurse, and she nursed him through all of it and had two or three of his children. And as soon as he got famous, they got a divorce, and he started going out with Sheryl Crow. And the minute I heard that, I said, even back in the day when this guy was immensely popular, I said, that guy's a jerk. That guy's just a jerk. And, you know, he's clearly, there's something wrong there. And throughout all that period in 2000, everybody was championing him. All I could think is, you just wait. The real story of this guy is going to come out. And it just, you know, it just told me everything I needed to know about the man. I don't know why Zimmerman is cavorting around with some girlfriend, getting her potentially pregnant, and talking about firearms with her when he had a wife who stuck through him while he was being prosecuted. Maybe she's the one who dumped him because she couldn't stand him. I don't know. But, you know, there's just something wrong with somebody like that who just can't quite stay out of trouble, in my opinion.
Wow. And it goes quiet.
Well,
you bring up the good points. I'm amazed. I think the next time we read about Zimmerman, he's going to be dead.
Well, you hope that people. It's hard to see the warning signs sometimes, and it's hard to pull your head out of fill in the blank. But this guy's clearly got, you know, he got a new lease on life. He's got to get on the right path here, but some people never do it. And, you know, see O.J. Simpson. I mean, this was a classic guy who literally got away with murder, and he had a chance to just go quietly off to Florida and live a peaceful, law-abiding life and try to be a decent person. And he just couldn't do it. And it suggests if these people can't get on the right track, then it suggests there's something deep down inside of them that has them programmed to go down these paths, and it's just a matter of time before they do. I'm all about people trying to correct themselves and get on a better path in life, but, you know, when you keep getting opportunities and you can't make the right decisions, then, you know, pretty soon you're going to end up in one place and one place only, the outhouse.
Can't argue with that.
Makes me think of a TARDIS, you know, bigger on the inside than on the outside.
There you go.
Zoom! What a great opening line. Okay.
You have to explain to everybody what a TARDIS is, and you have to translate the acronym because I always screw it up.
All righty. Yesterday marked the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who airing on British TV. And I hate to say it, I did watch the first episode. I was 5-6 years old.
November 23rd, 1963.
Right. Was that the first episode? Wow. Well, Simon,
yep.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
I was looking forward to yesterday's premiere, whatever it was, and there was a scene at the end when one of the old doctors came back and did a cameo. Which doctor was he? Was he the first one, the second one? Which one was he, if you know? Did you know that scene at the end?
No, I didn't watch it. I do know that the first doctor was William Hartnell, and he was older than dirt when he started the project.
So you don't think he's still with us?
I'm pretty certain. He died 40 years ago.
Oh. Okay, well, it must have been
one of
the stuff that we talked
about. I have information.
Please, help me.
My son watched it, and it was my favorite doctor, Tom Baker, was the one that did the cameo at the end of the show.
That's the one
I saw more episodes were, which was the number 4 doctor.
And what was his name, Tom Campbell?
Tom Baker.
Baker, sorry. Okay, well, that's good. Thank you for answering that. Well, for whatever it's worth, I find that show fascinating, and I only started watching it in recent years when I upped my cable TV program, and suddenly I started getting BBC America and started falling in love with that channel. And for those of you who aren't geeks or techies, it's basically a story about someone who could travel anywhere in space and time, and that's basically it. And God knows, wouldn't we all want to do that every now and then?
Yes. And what's even better is to look at its early beginnings, where it was only a few $100 per set that they ever spent, and that the actors were paid a few $100 per episode. That was it.
Well, I saw a scene from one of those old episodes, and, you know, for those who don't know it, there's a there's a band of little robots that destroy people, and they look like evil R2-D2s, but back in the old days, they used to roll them along with the Daleks, and they used to roll them on cobblestone streets, and they would wobble back and forth, and I thought that was the funniest thing I'd ever seen.
I just love this program, and you know, certainly the first few seasons, there was a little bit of a problem with the scenery. You know, it tended to wobble because it was made out of cardboard.
And sometimes the words of the boxes would bleed through the paint.
Right. Yeah. But, I mean, last night, I sat and watched two complete episodes of Doctor Who. And yeah, it's about an hour each. three programs per deal. And I love the Daleks, and the other one has to be the Cybermen. What could be better?
Well, I just think that the Daleks look like evil R2-D2s from a parallel universe. That's all I keep thinking every time I see them.
But you have to admit, they are fun.
Well, I like it. I'm a sci-fi geek type, and I'm one of those nerds who likes that kind of stuff. So it's right up my alley. That's the kind of stuff I like to watch. I just decided I would flip back on to BBC America right now, and they're showing the episode, Simon, where he's eating fish sticks and custard. So that's another inside Doctor Who reference. And that's British humor for you. It's I like it, and it's interesting because they always have these little subtle inside jokes, and if you're not keeping up with things, you miss them. But I enjoy that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know what's even amazing to me that this global broadcast, they had it made arrangements in over 1,500 movie theaters to be shown worldwide. So you could go in there, and some of them were actually in 3D. It's just amazing that people would go to that extent to actually watch this live broadcast in the movie theaters.
I didn't realize how popular it was in the United States. I mean, I got the impression I was the only guy here watching this show, but apparently not.
Yeah.
Was it Tom Baker that had the really long
scarf? Yes, that was Tom Baker. That's what I grew up on.
And
that's
they actually
who I grew
had
up
an
on.
Inside. They had an inside joke about that because at the beginning of that episode last night, there was somebody else with a scarf, and they made a comment about that.
All righty. My now ex-wife, but I have no bad feelings, built me a Tom Baker scarf for Christmas one year. And I was the happiest guy on the planet. Yeah.
Where were you when you were sporting this scarf?
I was in England, I think.
Well, that's a good place to have a scarf. I don't think it'd go over well in San Diego or Mississippi, for that matter.
Right, but I didn't have a TARDIS. I was walking around with this wonderful scarf, but no police box to run away on.
Boy, you were really missing out, weren't you?
Yeah. Indeed. Okay. Let's move on again. Afghanistan. Definitely not a spot on everyone's vacation list. apparently, they are now asking for our military help. We have, or are in the process pulling out, and once again, the country seems to be, crashing into civil war. What should we do? Yeah, should we walk away? I don't think that we need any more involvement in the Middle East.
Well, what was it Colin Powell said? You break it, you buy it. That's his great line.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what the right thing is to do, but my understanding is that the Afghan elders, and I assume that they are somehow the spokespersons of what is currently Afghanistan, are requesting that the U.S. maintain some presence there even after military operations have ended. And if in fact that's a genuine request, and if in fact there's a good basis for it, I'm just not so sure we can just walk away and abandon them. If we're going to help maintain some semblance of order, and if that's what the country wants us to do, and those may be two big ifs, but if those are both answered in the affirmative, then I tend to think we ought to try to help out with that as best we can. It's a complicated scenario, and who knows how much more violence awaits us in that region. But I do tend to think that that we have a bit of a responsibility to try and manage our exit as humanely and as civilly as we can.
Okay. All right. That was a great answer. And yeah, one that could only come from a lawyer.
Right? Are you saying I failed to answer the question?
I mean, Russia played with it for 10 years. We have played with it for 12 years. My personal view is let it crash and burn, and let us pick up the pieces afterwards.
Oh.
Sam,
no.
No. Oh, okay. All right. And Bill obviously has something to say.
Well, of all the countries that we're involved with, and all the conflicts and all the military actions, we finally get one in the last 20 years where somebody actually is asking for the United States to be involved. I think we got to capitalize on this one, because we're always in the wrong place where we're unwanted. We got to do something right when it comes to foreign involvement in other countries. These people are actually asking us to come and help them. When has that ever happened? We always stick our nose into where it doesn't belong. This is kind of exciting. This is I'm not even sure if our military strategists can figure out how to respond to this, because they want us there. Isn't that kind of weird?
Well, I think it is unusual, and I think if it's true that they really want us there, you never really quite know who's representing whom. But if they do want us there and we're needed, I tend to agree with you, Bill. I think we shouldn't turn our backs on them. That's what I think.
Sam, you must have some grumpy response.
I hate to rain on everybody's parade, but
we got to get out. I don't think our military's capable. You know, my son's in the military. He's home for the week, blessedly. I'm happy to say I'm going to stuff him like a Thanksgiving Day turkey on Thursday. But in a few moments, I had a chance to talk to him before his friend dragged him out, you know, kicking and screaming to go have a couple beers and watch football today. He was telling me how due to the sequester, due to many, many, many things as he's heard, you know, the rumors, at least in the Air Force and whatnot, that we are woefully unprepared to be helping anybody at this point. We're spread too thin. People aren't being trained. A lot of people they're cutting back. The cuts have happened, and therefore, I don't think when he just based upon I'm going to go with what my son was saying, just strategically. Strategically, we're not ready. We're not capable of right now unless we start to spend our monies correctly, and redirect resources to where they're supposed to go. That has to happen before I'd even think about going anywhere. My son said he was watching someone C-SPAN or something when the Secretary of the Army got out and said, "We better hope we're not attacked. We better hope some catastrophe doesn't happen with the military needed to strength, because we're in dire straits right now with the military." Hard to believe, with all the money we spend and this and that, that we're stretched pretty thin right now, but that's what my son has said and others. So based upon that, I'd be very hesitant to go anywhere, anytime, any place. And again, it boggles my mind that with how much money we spend on defense, we're not ready for a catastrophe, a war-type catastrophe. That's not my number one reason. My number two reason is, how much more are we going to help out? What are we going to get for it? You guys tell me, Bill, what are we going to get? Someone asked us to come in. Every day, I bet you Obama gets a phone call from some country that says, "Mr. President, please send us X, fill in the blank." When can we say no? Because I have a serious problem with what's going on with our own country. We got kids walking around streets knocking people out. We've got, you know, and everyone thinks that, you know, that's we're shocked by it, but we shouldn't be. We've got Detroit's in bankruptcy, falling apart. The inequities and well, I mean, we've got some serious. But we can't even roll. We're going to go help another country, and we can't even roll out a website. I mean, I just don't think, you know, I think we've got other priorities. We really got to get.
Yeah, we can roll it out.
Put a man on the moon, but we can't start a website.
We can roll out a website.
Yeah.
It may not work, but we can roll it out.
We rolled it over. We didn't roll it out.
What was the website about where you could buy drugs online?
No.
I assume you're not talking about some sort of pharmaceutical website where you get a prescription. You're talking about, like, you know,
yeah,
buy marijuana, send it here.
Silk Road.
Why can't we get the Department of, drug? I'm drawing a blank. Why can't we just take their technology from that and apply it to healthcare? I mean, we've confiscated the website. Why don't that was working really well and people were able to buy drugs really easily. Why can't we just move that one over there and make a few mods to it?
Because there's no money. There's no money for the sticky fingers that get there. But again, to answer your question, I just don't think. Let's take care of all our problems. Here, I think we need to scale back foreign aid on the great thing. But, you know, we just can't. We got to say no to some of these countries and let them do their own things. And it was We gotta get out. I'd rather see our military, patrolling the streets of Chicago than somewhere else where the motors, are way up and things of that nature. And I just want to see some cuts in foreign aid because I want to see that aid find its way back to the American people who've been suffering long and dear.
Oh, Sam, I agree with you, but now you're talking about intelligence in our government system. There's so much wrong with that. You're saying essentially is that if we don't provide foreign aid, that we'll be able to cure the woes of America. And we can't. We have the same incompetent people running both in the United States as well as foreign aid. We need a whole restructuring and we need to get rid of the administration and start all over again, because the problem is that the same incompetent people are running inside the United States as well as outside. That's our problem.
The worst thing about a democracy is the bureaucracy that comes with it. And that's what we've got.
Yeah.
And it's not just this administration. It was the previous administration. It was the previous administration before that. There's a lot of money in foreign aid. And there's a lot of...
Yes, there is.
That's what we have to change.
But if we pull it back from foreign aid, they're just going to spend it in a stupider manner.
Here's one of the big problems about foreign aid that Simon lectured me on. In America, we only have to worry about the crooks in America. In foreign aid, now you have to work double crooks. You have the crooks in America, then you have the crooks in the country that we're sending the money to. So you have two sets of crooks you have to worry about. So at least in America, we only have one set of crooks to worry about. Legitimate crooks, by the way.
Well, if you start spending the money on American crooks, they'll figure out a way to get to funnel the money out of the United States anyway because they have to secure their investments.
Bill, my favorite thing is we spend $94 billion a month to prop up the crooks in Wall Street and the banks. Think if we could take 1 month, just 1 month, these guys can't go without their money and spread that money to all the Americans who pay taxes.
You think?
Everyone who pays taxes gets $1 million or whatever it is. I don't know. Just that. Instead of 1 month, Wall Street doesn't get their money. But all that $94 billion is spread. Let's do it for three. Let's give every American whatever. And then you're on your own. A day of jubilee in reverse.
Absolutely.
But they can't do that. I mean, so I've always said this, and I put it in my novels. I always have a character say it, and I always will. In our world that we live in, with all the billions of people on it, there is enough money to cure all the ills in the world. It just doesn't get to where it's supposed to go to, and that's the biggest problem.
That's right.
And how do you do that? If I could answer that, I'd be sitting in a cave with a long beard, and people would come from far and wide to ask me questions like, why is it that men are more sexually, great questions. Why do men have their sexual peaks in their teenagehood and women get theirs in their 40s? And I'd be able to give a great answer, and people would crown me the guru of the world. But I can't
answer those questions. Women carrying guns wanting to date you, too.
I can answer, but you can't. We all have the great questions. I mean, on this show, I've listened to you, Bill, Simon, Manny, John Perry once in a great while. Peter, I'll bring up great questions, and unfortunately, the answers are so difficult because and that's one of the biggest problems. How do you stop this? How do you stop the greed? Because that's what it is. How do you stop the greed? How do you stop the system of greed that a few people are dependent upon? But boy, they'll kill, maim, murder, frame. They'll do anything they can to destroy the people who are the messengers who want to see change and bring that money or support or whatever it is to do the right thing. How do you stop that? Without an army.
Okay, I'm gonna hit Peter on that. How do we stop the greed?
Well, first of all, I couldn't agree more with what Sam says, and it's basically a consistent theme which I frequently echo, is that human beings, all of us to one degree or another, we suffer from an innate flaw in that, individually we're all susceptible to greed, and collectively it's a nightmare. And I all I can think is that greed is a natural force that's at work in the world. It's like the wind and the ocean and the waves, and you don't stop it by trying to resist it. You stop it or harness it in a way that makes it productive, and because that's the only way, in my opinion, that you can deal with a natural force that otherwise can't be reckoned with. You can't fight it. You can't make the rain stop. You can't make the waves stop. All you can do is try to harness the energy and point it in the right direction. Now, how you harness the energy of greed and point it in the right direction is something that I don't know how to do, because Sam points out the people who are capable of making the changes, if they don't feel properly incentivized, they will take advantage of it for their own personal benefit. And it's just it's an age-old problem that's plagued humanity from day one. I think the real answer is, or the theoretical answer is, you have to have some benevolent force that governs and controls everything. You know, the Greeks called it the greatest form of government is the benevolent dictator. The problem is you just don't have any benevolent dictators. They're human beings too, and they're all susceptible to evil and greed. And in my opinion, greed is just another way of saying evil. That's what, in my opinion, evil is. Evil is the manifestation of one's personal self-interest above the interests of others, and it's all just a question of degree. That's my philosophy. America was the great experiment. It was the effort to take power out of the hands of a monarchy, or whatever you want to call it, and put it in the hands of the people. And we're still suffering from similar problems. But I hold out hope that humanity's evolving, and that one day we'll get to some more altruistic state, and the betterment of all people will be a goal. But we're not there yet. And the biggest impediment to getting there, in my opinion, right now, is I think greed threatens to kill us all, because greed is what creates bad products, bad environment, weapons of mass destruction. Everything that exists in the world that can wipe out all of humanity is built in one form or another on a monument of greed. And, you know, if we don't kill each other, maybe we'll evolve to something better. But we stand in our own paths right now. Human beings we're our own greatest enemy. And I don't know how to overcome it. I just hope to goodness sake that we can.
Okay. I'm looking at the countdown clock, and we're getting close. So I want to go once around the table with all of my great guests. Sam, your parting thoughts.
My parting thoughts are that I want to congratulate you on your endeavor, that you're going to be the Ted Turner of the digital, of the bloggings of the world out there. I have no doubt about that. So congratulations on your new baby, and I hope it's fruitful and multiplies for you. And thank you for letting me be a part of it, too, at this show. I've had a wonderful time talking. The Browns stunk, so it was great. I look forward to around halftime. Oh, God, I can't wait till the show's on so I can gab and get my frustrations out by being entertained and educated by you three gentlemen, and I thank you for it. I wish everybody a blessed and wonderful Thanksgiving. Enjoy, be grateful, be thankful, and all that, and most importantly, eat, drink, and make merry.
And Bill.
It was an amazing discussion. I don't think anything spiraled out of control. It was good. It seemed like everyone was thinking clearly and not overly emotional. But aside from all that, again, I wish everybody a great Thanksgiving as well. It's just, enjoy your time with your family, and we'll look forward to next Sunday.
perfect. And Peter, you get the last word. Well, that's not quite true.
Well, I don't deserve the last word, but I do think that as we approach Thanksgiving, it's nice for everyone to try to be thankful for all the things we do have and try not to think too much about the things we don't, because it'll just get you down. And I wish everyone a very healthy and happy Thanksgiving.
And this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a great Thanksgiving. We will be back next week. Until then, goodbye.